Great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed. No, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to another episode of the Every Outfit podcast. We are coming to you nearly a week after the Oscars, mere blocks away from where the ceremony was held.
Since we're this late, shall we just get straight into it?
Let's get into it. Conan hosted the Oscars again. What did we think of his performance?
I thought he was great. I'm never nervous for Conan, and I can't say the same about other Oscars hosts.
Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah, exactly. He's one of the greats. He's always way less annoying than either of the Jimmys.
Yeah, and I don't think we're going to get an Ellen DeGeneres hosted Oscars anytime soon. But I do think it's hard when you host back-to-back years. Usually someone hosts, then someone else does, and then a favorite host comes back a few years later. Because you can't help but compare their performance to the previous year. And he was so stellar last year. And there were a few bumps during his monologue, but that was mostly due to the camera crew, I will say. That one guy who was on Leonardo DiCaprio, he missed his mark. I don't know where he was.
Oh, yeah, that was crazy. That stressed me out.
But it started as all good award shows start. I know Billy Crystal coined this, but an award show host putting themselves in the award nominated films, a glorious bit, always good.
Well, this one was perfect because he looked great as Aunt Gladys.
Shout out to our colorist, Casey, who is Conan's groomer and had to wrangle that wig on his head.
He looked perfect. I don't know. There's something about Conan. He feels a little more old school than your average talk show host. And I guess it's because he has been doing it for the longest at this point. But like, he comes from another era of show business.
Yes. Well, as he kept joking throughout the ceremony, he would soon be replaced by a robot or an influencer or someone like that. Conan is also not afraid to make it weird. I think it's a really rough crowd in the room because everyone is very tense and nervous, especially for the monologue, because they've been waiting for this night and seemingly have been on a press tour for a year straight and everyone is starving. I saw that they made little snack boxes for the people in the audience, which I thought was very smart. But I feel like there's always a tension with an award show host where they have to make a decision of like, are they playing to the room or are they playing to the audience, which is much bigger watching at home?
Right. Ideally, they should be able to do both.
And I think Conan does both very well.
I also loved the bit at the very end, the one battle after another parody.
Right. Co-starring Jim Downey, who Conan worked with when he was on Saturday Night Live. So that was a very cute reunion.
Very funny. And, you know, he had no problem shitting on Trump, certainly, during the Oscars.
I mean, shitting on Trump, shitting on the state of Hollywood. I think he went a little too hard, for me at least, throughout the award show about the impending death of Hollywood. It's like, I know, but can we just leave it alone for one evening?
Shall we get into some of the winners?
Of course. The big winner of the night was One Battle After Another, which took home 6 awards. Best Picture, Best Director, Adapted Screenplay, Editing, Casting, and of course, Best Supporting Actor to Sean Penn, who was not there.
He definitely deserved it. That performance was incredible, but it always makes me sad for the other nominees when someone wins that isn't even there.
I really do think that if you are not there to receive your award, they should just give it to the person who came in second.
I agree.
I joked to Paul, I was like, what, is he with Vladimir Zelensky? And he was. And the reason I made that joke is, I don't know if you know this, Chell, in 2022, Sean Penn went to visit President Zelensky in Ukraine and gave him one of his Best Actor Oscars.
The Milk one or the Mystic River one?
That's what he won for. No word on which award he gave him, but he did say at the time, I feel terrible. This is for you. It's just a symbolic, silly thing. But I know if this is here with you, then I'll feel better and stronger for the fight.
That is, Oscar is in some bunker in Ukraine?
His Oscar, his Gus Van Sant.
Well, we don't know which one it is.
It's true. He also said, when you win, this is to Zelensky, bring it back to Malibu. I'll feel much better knowing a piece of me is here.
Wow.
Well, now Zelensky's got to bring it back to you in Malibu, of all places?
Now he has another one to give him, potentially. I was a bit sad. I wanted Stellan Skarsgård to win.
Or Delroy Lindo. I mean, if you look, that's always the fun thing as someone that compulsively watches award shows, is looking at those little boxes of all the nominees when the winner is called, because Delroy Lindo didn't even clap. He was like, fuck this.
Yeah, it sucks for him. It sucks to lose to someone who is clearly jaded and doesn't give a shit. Like, it's cool of Sean Penn that he doesn't give a shit, but I think that's only because he has two other Oscars and now he has a third.
Yeah, and the best thing he did, ironically, for his awards campaign was to not campaign at all.
He didn't need to campaign. He did so much in that tight black t-shirt. That uncomfortably tight t-shirt that he was wearing.
We were thankfully saved from a 6-minute sanctimonious speech, though.
That's true. You know whose speech I loved? The gay guy that won for editing that movie that thanked his archivist aunt who worked for the Academy, apparently.
I always love Hollywood lore. I also love when people who win awards give context to the people they're thanking instead of just being like, and Patty and Eric and you know who you are. It's like, yeah, but I don't know who they are. Also, one battle after another won the first ever casting award. Cassandra Koulikoudis won. She started her creative collaboration with P.T. Anderson on Magnolia, and they have worked together ever since. She was also the casting director behind Ghost World, Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle, Her, Vox Lux, the rebooted Gossip Girl, and The Brutalist. So she's also Brady Corbet's girl as well.
Amazing. I love that.
Of course, Papa P.T. Anderson finally won his Best Director Oscar. You and I were discussing this where I was like, well, I mean, he won for screenplay for Phantom Thread back in 2017. And it was like, no, he didn't.
I can't believe they never gave him screenplay. They should have given him screenplay for Boogie Nights. I can't believe that Boogie Nights wasn't even nominated for Best Picture. I didn't realize that either.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think he even got screenplay for that. I believe famously there is a video of him, maybe on some substances, very upset that he's not nominated.
He was nominated for screenplay, but he lost to Matt Damon and Ben Affleck because it was the Good Will Hunting Titanic year.
Which I think is a good time to point out that the Oscars are not a meritocracy. I know a lot of people were upset that Ryan Coogler did not win Best Director. And you know what? I agree with you. He should have won Best Director because P.T. Anderson should have won Best Director 3 times previously. But unfortunately, again, the Oscars are not a meritocracy. They are at times a popularity contest. And sometimes we give it to 25, 27-year-old handsome actors who've written a screenplay.
Yeah. You know what was nominated that year instead of Boogie Nights? The Full Monty.
Ooh.
For Picture. Can you imagine?
Well, look, F1 was nominated for Best Picture. But, you know, that is, the Full Monty being nominated is pretty egregious when you think that at the time there were only 5 Best Picture nominees. Now there are 10. So, like, when something like F1 gets nominated, you're like, all right.
Yeah.
But is it the point of nominating F1 the idea that Brad Pitt will come to the Oscars? Because he didn't.
See, I've just been avoiding that whole movie. I didn't even know he was in it.
Yeah, he's kind of the star.
What else? Amy Madigan won. That was cool.
Yeah, her win isn't exactly a surprise.
It was kind of a surprise.
Well, I just mean that the Academy tends to favor career Oscars. I know I'm contradicting myself being like, it's not a meritocracy, it's a popularity contest. But paradoxically, they also will give older actors Oscars, especially in the Best Supporting Actress category. I think of Jamie Lee Curtis. Not to say that Amy Madigan is not deserving of her Best Supporting Actress.
Oh, she definitely is. But it's fascinating to see which horror performances the Academy chooses to recognize, because you won't even nominate Toni Collette for Hereditary.
I was just about to say, still not over that.
No.
She was very cute. It feels like, despite the fact that she has been on a whole awards press run, people just realized that she's married to Ed Harris and has been for the last 40 years.
And he is looking good, might I say.
They both look great. It's nice to see a non-facelift, non-Ozempic person.
Also, I like that she thanked the cast of Sinners and One Battle After Another, because I didn't think about the fact that, like, she was like a solo agent during award season because no one else from Weapons was nominated for shit. So imagine going to all of those award shows and all of those luncheons by yourself, essentially.
Well, she does have Ed Harris by her side.
Okay, yeah, she gets a plus one, obviously, but still, that's very different than just looking around and seeing entire tables populated with people from certain movies.
Also, the writer-director, Zach Cregger, could not be with her during her awards run, even to be her plus one, because he has been in, I believe, Prague shooting a Resident Evil reboot.
Never saw the first one, so.
The first five?
Oh, I didn't know there were five.
Directed by Mila Jovovich's husband, Paul W.S. Anderson.
That's an unfortunate name to have if you're a director.
I wonder if Paul Thomas Anderson, because in the Actors Guild, you cannot have the same name as a known actor. That's why Michael Keaton's real name is Michael Douglas, actually. And he picked Keaton for Diane Keaton. That's why he's Michael Keaton. So I wonder if the Directors Guild has the same rule where it's like, I'm sorry, you both can't be Paul Anderson.
Makes sense. Michael B. Jordan, of course, won for Best Actor. A great Oscars moment.
He looked great. It seemed like the room itself was vibrating when he won.
The In-N-Out burger was vibrating later that day. It's very cute.
It's interesting that at the beginning of this award season, it really felt like a far-gone conclusion that Timmy was going to win. And there has been this energy, even if you don't care about award season, just in the last 2 weeks where it was like, no, Michael B. Jordan's going to win. And indeed, Michael B. Jordan won.
Well, I have to say, I'm not here for this Timmy slander that seems to have been picking up steam in recent weeks.
Again, just to put this win in the context of the Oscars. One, Michael B. Jordan played two roles, so there's that. But also, the Oscars typically in the Best Actor category does not typically award young actors. So Michael B. Jordan has been acting since he was a child. He is 39 years old. Timmy is 30. The youngest ever awarded actor in this category was Adrian Brody at the age of 29. The second youngest person was Adrian Brody, winning the second time for The Brutalist. Just to let you know the age discrepancy of best actors.
Sure, but he's been consistently nominated. And this is the third film that he fully deserved to win for.
But it's an unlikable role. And I think people have fused his character with his press run.
It's an unlikable role. Aunt Gladys won Best Supporting Actress. You have a problem with Marty Supreme? I'm just not into the fact that people are talking about him like he's annoying and entitled in this brat pack sort of way. When at the end of the day, he's a brilliant actor. And I think that these opera and ballet comments were so blown out of proportion. Like, all he was saying is that these are art forms that have waned in popularity with the mainstream, which is true. And also, if you need Kylie Jenner's boyfriend to validate opera and ballet as an art form, there's something wrong with you. I'm sorry.
But I do find it sort of ironic that he's making these comments at a time where years ago, Steven Spielberg discuss the theatrical movie-going experience, that it would go the way of theater and opera and ballet. So I do think it's kind of funny because it's like, but that is what is going to happen to the theatrical movie-going experience in 20 years. So it's a little funny that you are like, no, I'm part of a popular art.
People will still watch movies regardless of whether it's in a theater or at home, though.
Right, but he has made a choice not to do any streaming films, to not be a part of comic book films. Like, he's been very specific in his choices. I do think that he did some things, again, it's a popularity contest, that annoyed the Academy voters. One of which was he did not go to the governor's ball, which is a big deal. Like, if you look at someone like Eddie Redmayne, who won for, what did he win for?
That movie.
It's not Everything Everywhere All at Once, but it has a title like that.
The Theory of Everything.
I knew everything was in there somewhere. But Eddie Redmayne did all the things. He went to all the screenings. He went to all the Academy events. And Timmy didn't. He evidently showed up late to the Academy nominee luncheon, which...
Did Sean Penn show up for that? Because he won.
You got me there. I feel like not enough people are discussing the context of this opera and ballet comments, because it comes from a town hall interview that he did or made Matthew McConaughey do with him for CNN. Like, it's such an unforced error.
Is it that big of an error? People are acting like he said something heinous and reprehensible.
There is a weird tension when it comes to award season, and Anne Hathaway faced this wrath as well, which is, if you want it too much, people don't like that. And Timmy did a whole kind of parallel press path where, I don't know if you know this, Chelsea, but between Los Angeles and New York, he did his own film retrospective.
Oh, yes, I heard about that. Because he has enough good movies, even at the young age of what? How old is he?
He's 30.
To do a retrospective of his own films.
Look,
he's being hated on because he's talented and popular. And he's so popular that he can't even make an innocuous comment about opera and ballet without getting dragged.
I saw some tweet that was like, I guess Timmy's going back to the gay asylum.
But the fact that when he was speaking with Matthew McConaughey, he immediately acknowledged no disrespect to ballet and opera. Perhaps I'm just taking this personally because I can imagine getting negative feedback for something similar. Like, we probably said something comparable about print media. And it's not that serious. It's not that deep, obviously.
Yeah, I think Timmy losing does not signal that he's no longer going to have a career. Like, he's going to win an Oscar at some point. He perhaps is on the Leonardo DiCaprio trajectory where he won't get there for another 15 years, but...
Yeah, they like to haze the twinks at the Academy.
Well, I do think part of the problem is every year award season gets longer and longer. And the issue of being the favorite at the top of the award season is it is very easy to fall out of favor.
Sure, but Marty Supreme was a great movie and it deserved something.
That's right. It got nominated, I think, 9 times and won nothing.
I think it also deserved to win for casting. I would have voted for that in the casting category.
Or costume.
Yeah.
But of course, Frankenstein was going to walk away with all of the technical awards.
Yes.
Shall we get into the second biggest winner of the night, Sinners, which had 4 awards. Michael B. Jordan, as we just mentioned. It also won score, cinematography, best original screenplay for Ryan Coogler.
I feel like I see that guy that won for score more than a lot of my closest friends.
Ludwig Göransson?
Yeah.
Yeah, he is a kind of Phineas's Wario where they're like always at the Oscars, always at the Grammys, always winning.
He stays winning.
I wonder if Ludwig Göransson has become the millennial Hans Zimmer.
He absolutely has. This man has 3 Oscars. And he looks like some guy that you would randomly see at Squirrel or something.
Ludwig Göransson met Ryan Coogler at USC. They have had a lifelong working relationship together. Although Ludwig now works on Christopher Nolan films, which is why he feels omnipresent and omni-awarded.
Can we also talk about this, like, extremely cool chick that won for cinematography?
Autumn Durald Arkapaw. Yes, this is her 2nd collaboration with Ryan Coogler. He, I believe, has always worked with a female cinematographer, Rachel Morrison, before. Rachel Morrison was the first female to ever get nominated for cinematography. Autumn is now the first female to ever win Best Academy Award for Cinematography.
She also looked very cool.
Oh, yeah.
In her Tom Brown outfit.
And I thought it was very sweet. There's something, just the energy that Ryan Coogler and the team and his cast and crew, it's very clear that they're all very close to each other. I don't know if you caught that Ryan Coogler ran back to where her son was because she shouted him out and was like carrying him up close to the stage so he could see his mom give her award speech.
That's cute.
But she has also, if you enjoy her work and want to see more of her work, she worked with Gia Coppola on Last Showgirl and Palo Alto. And then, of course, Ryan Coogler won Best Original Screenplay. I feel like I called that.
Also, Diane Warren lost again. Like, how many times can they degrade this woman in this way?
We are currently watching the comeback for a VIP episode, and it's giving Valerie Cherish. Although Diane Warren on the red carpet was like, because someone, of course, was asking her about it. She has become literally the Susan Lucci of the Oscars. And she was like, no, I love it. I don't think she was coping. I think she genuinely, like, it's an honor to keep losing.
No, her face said otherwise when they announced the, like, K-pop Demon Hunter song. Because, like, how many Oscars luncheons has this woman gone to? Like, she has lost weeks of her life to the Oscars.
Weeks, probably years. Hasn't she been nominated 17, 18 times? That's definitely at least a year or two of your life.
Starting with the theme song from Mannequin, of course.
I didn't make this joke, someone online did, but they posit that the only way that Diane Warren is going to win an Oscar is if she plays Ghislaine Maxwell.
It must suck to have the Ghislaine haircut these days.
What else was notable? Oh, the tie for the short film winners?
Love it.
I mean, we love some drama, some unexpected drama. However, as two people that compulsively have watched award shows our entire life, I feel like this happens in all the technical categories and also in the short film categories, because it's usually like a duo or a group of people that come on stage. You guys, one of you can't give a speech and then expect that the next one can give a full-ass speech and not be played off. The animated short guys got it. They did their speech in tandem. One would say a line, then the next one would say a line, then one would say a line, then the next one would say a line.
Yeah, it was really rude how they played off, like, one of the K-pop Demon Hunter people.
Well, Conan pointed out, because the camera cut to Conan after the second person in the second winning short film group went to speak, that they not only played him off, but they lowered his mic to get him to stop speaking. And then he just kept speaking to a point where they raised the mic back up.
Crazy. Shall we get into some of the presenters?
Absolutely. Now, Conan's monologue, great, strong. I can only imagine what it takes to put the Oscars together, how much material you have to come up with. However, the presenter's bits overall, not the strongest.
I agree. Although, fun to see Anna Wintour.
Does she have a financial stake in The Devil Wears Prada 2?
She should.
Does she have a producing credit I'm unaware of?
She, of course, presented with Anne Hathaway, which makes me think that Meryl canceled. Because did Meryl cancel because of Martin Short's daughter's suicide?
That's interesting.
I just don't see how this would be anyone's first choice for this bit. Like, if she came out with Meryl, people would have died.
Yes. And I believe Anne Hathaway has already come out with Emily Blunt as a presenter. So, like, that's already been done. But, like, the idea that Anna Wintour would be the backup choice and she would say yes?
No, I don't think Anna Wintour was the backup choice. I think that Anne Hathaway was the backup choice.
Oh, you thought it was Anna Wintour and Meryl Streep. Got it.
Anna Wintour and Meryl Streep would pack a much bigger punch than Anna Wintour and Anne Hathaway.
That's interesting.
I think that Anne Hathaway was a replacement, and Anna was understandably fine with it, given the circumstances, I would imagine.
It's funny. I was like, why is Anna not wearing her signature sunglasses? And of course, it was a bit where she's ignoring Anne Hathaway at the end.
I thought Anna was great, but you could see that she's like viscerally uncomfortable when she doesn't have her sunglasses.
Yeah. Well, as we learned in the Amy Odell biography about Anna Wintour, the sunglasses are not just an armor because she is very shy. She's also evidently blind. And so she has very powerful prescriptions in those sunglasses.
She also evidently wore them in the theater when she was seeing The Devil Wears Prada the first time, like when she went to the premiere.
She can't see, Chelsea.
There was also that weird bit with Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr. Robert Downey Jr. was missing so many of his marks that I questioned if he had relapsed or not, although I don't think that that's actually the case.
Yeah, as a former Marvel nerd, this was very hard for me to witness, mostly because these are two men who have spent the last 5 or 6 years purposely distancing themselves from the Marvel Cinematic Universe only to now be back in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is why they were presenting together. They were presenting screenwriting, which I also noticed they doubled up on the presenters, what they were presenting. Like, usually it's one award. This time it was two awards. So they were doing Best Original Screenplay and Best Adapted Screenplay. Usually the presenters have a bit about what they are presenting. This year, almost every bit was about something else, which, like, we don't need to introduce a new element. Like, for Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr., it was a joke about how it was their anniversary because it's been 14 years, not even a good anniversary, since the Avengers came out, and did you get me a present? And then Robert Downey Jr.'s present was a thong that came from Channing Tatum. Awful comedic timing, except for Channing Tatum, who has excellent comedic timing.
Yeah, he's perfect. The Bridesmaids reunion, obviously a more notable moment. It made me really happy to see them all together.
I love seeing them all together, but can you explain to me what the bit is supposed to be? That people in the audience have written notes for them, but only them.
Hey, I'm with you. I was struck at how well their gowns complemented each other. Like, it was as if they were styled as a group for, like, the Vanity Fair Hollywood issue or something.
I feel like they're all still genuinely friends with each other. So I'm sure there's a group chat where they did indeed coordinate. Or maybe they put all their stylists on a group chat and were like, figure it out.
Yeah, because it was all like black and silver and champagne and stuff like that.
Now, should we get to the in memoriam section?
So much to discuss.
Is this the best in memoriam in Oscars history? It is at the very least the most in memoriam in Oscars history.
Well, compared to the Grammys in memoriam that we just saw, this was nothing. I don't know. To me, this had a lot of highs and lows. The Rob Reiner tribute, very effective. Billy Crystal was great. Seeing all the actors that were in his films together, incredibly moving.
To see them all in a line together, going film by film, seeing everyone from Christopher Guest to Kiefer Sutherland to Fred Savage to Carol Kane to John Cusack.
Delightful.
Also, I had no idea. I knew that Billy Crystal and Rob Reiner were lifelong friends. I didn't know their friendship started in 1975 when Billy Crystal was cast as his best friend in All in the Family.
That's really cute and really sad, considering what just happened to him.
Yeah, that your friend dies on your 50th anniversary of knowing each other.
Dies is a warm and fuzzy way of describing what happened to him.
So that was definitely a high. What would you say was a low?
The low, I would say, was the photo editor.
Okay.
Whoever was responsible for choosing the photographs of the people that passed away and whoever was responsible with silhouetting those photographs should be incarcerated.
Well, also, I think for timing to accommodate all of the special speakers, let's say, eulogizing certain actors who passed away, they had to double up the in memoriam cards, which they usually never do.
But not for everyone, just for like publicists and more behind the scenes people, not like for the major actors.
No.
But still, very rude. And I know I'm harping on about this, but the silhouetting, Lauren, it was like, you know how like you can automatically do that on your phone now?
Yes.
It was like that. Like, no one even did a second pass retouching those silhouettes.
Well, clearly they were doing them up until the last second because they forgot some notable people, as they always do, which is kind of the fun, if there is any fun to be had during the in memoriam section, is like, who are they going to miss?
I don't think it's fun for the friends and the family of the people whose loved one was omitted from the Oscars egregiously, as was the case with James Vanderbeek, which I get it. He's mostly known for Dawson's Creek, but the Rules of Attraction. Come on, guys.
Varsity Blues Erasure? We will not have this on the Every Outfit podcast.
Horrible.
I saw that people were also upset that Eric Dane was omitted, but Shonda Rhimes was recently on the red carpet post-Oscars and was like, no, I get it. He's a TV actor. So if those two don't have a special section during the Emmys in memoriam, then we riot.
For sure. Also, I really love Rachel McAdams as an actor, but I think that was a strange choice for Diane Keaton because no one's thinking like, oh, you know, Diane Keaton's most iconic movie, The Family Stone, co-starring Rachel McAdams in a supporting role.
I mean, us and I think our podcast listeners do think of her in that way. I will say that section was weird because it was like Diane Keaton, but also Catherine O'Hara. And I think they chose Rachel McAdams because they're like, she worked with Diane Keaton and she's Canadian. So we can tick off those two boxes.
I don't know. Like Goldie Hawn was there. Jane Fonda was there. We could have gone book club with this. I feel like Candace Bergen would have hopped on a plane from New York.
Well, Jane Fonda had less of an issue about not being asked to speak about Diane Keaton and more had an issue with not being asked to speak about Robert Redford.
Yeah, because she said this very funny thing to a reporter, which was a joke that got completely blown out of context, where she was like, why is Barbara Streisand presenting? She only did one movie with Robert. I did four. And that is how I learned that Jane Fonda and Robert Redford did four films together, because I have only ever seen Barefoot in the Park.
I'm with you. No clue.
Like, that was a shocking revelation to me. Like, if this was a question from Ghostface in a Scream murder scenario, I would have been dead. For me, Barbara Streisand was one of the highlights of the entire show. Obviously, because I'm a fan, but because her speech kind of did everything. She offered up moving personal anecdotes. She sang The Way We Were.
Yeah, I mean, this is all I care about when it comes to Hollywood, that Robert Redford would just randomly call her up on evenings and like make fun of her. In true Barbara Streisand fashion, it did feel like she was airing out a little bit of a grievance where she's like, he always called me Babs. Why? And it's like, that is your nickname.
I don't think it was a grievance. I thought that was a very cute story. She mentioned that for the punchline, which was perfect.
Right. But I also think she was like, look, that's something Robert Redford can call me. That's not something you guys can call me.
What else?
Zendaya and Robert Pattinson were presenters, the only non-cringe presenters, mostly because they're just so attractive. I think it overcame any cringy banter they possibly had.
They looked really, really hot. I'm already excited to see the drama, but now I'm very excited to see the drama.
They have three movies together this year. The Drama, The Odyssey, and Dune 3.
That's crazy.
I hope they like each other because they're going to be on three separate press tours this year. They're poor stylists. Although that was pretty cool that she re-wore her 2015 Golden Globes Vivian Westwood wedding dress to the drama premiere this week.
Very cool. Especially since that's the dress that got Fashion Police canceled, as many people have pointed out.
RIP, 11 years without it, and we miss her every day.
Can you imagine Juliana Rancic like refreshing her Instagram feed being like, fuck.
The darkest day of her life.
I don't think it was the darkest day of her life. She's had some dark days, as we know.
Well, I was going to say, it's like we've gone back recently and watched a lot of old Fashion Police, or I guess the second or third iteration of Fashion Police, and a lot of fucked up stuff was said in that show.
Yep.
So the thing about the Oscars is it's, I feel like at this point, one of the few live broadcast things we actually watch, which forces us to watch the commercials. And there were some bizarre ones, if we could discuss just for a second.
Okay, the Natalie Portman Tiffany ad.
Does that mean she's free from being Miss Dior? I need to know.
I don't know. I was so confused by what I saw. I meant to go back and watch it like five times in a row until I understood it, but I don't even know if that would help.
She is Natalie Portman, but in a director mode, but dressed to look like Audrey Hepburn, and we're playing Moon River.
Yeah. So many Breakfast at Tiffany's dog whistles.
But this is what I always wonder about celebrity ambassadors. Does this make someone want to buy new Tiffany jewelry?
It must, or they wouldn't do it. But also, she has this crazy unhinged voiceover about like inner strength and stuff.
Encourage. Impatient open hands. At the core of what makes us human. You'll see. You don't have to be perfect to experience perfect moments. This is where inner strength grows best.
I will say, this ad looked great. Like, props to the cinematographer.
Natalie Portman looks beautiful. I wonder if she did at any point when she was shown the creative, like, hey guys, I'm in my 40s. Like, I get it. I do kind of look like Audrey Hepburn, but like, should we be doing this in an ad? Like, I have directed my own films. Like, I, you know, I can stand on my own.
It's weird to do it and not fully commit to it.
Right, because she's dressed as Audrey Hepburn, but she's directing a Tiffany commercial within a Tiffany commercial?
I honestly don't understand this ad at all.
We potentially have spent more time thinking about the plot of this commercial than the creative agency.
Yeah.
Speaking of muddled concepts for ads, the Zendaya career retrospective Rolex ad, I genuinely thought it was a commercial for one of those AFI Lifetime Achievement Awards, where I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess Zendaya's having a big year. She has, I think, 4 or 5 films coming out. She's also in the new Spider-Man film, in addition to the 3 other films she's in with Robert Pattinson. So I was like, oh.
And Euphoria, don't forget.
Oh, Euphoria season 3, of course. How could I forget? So I was like, oh, okay, maybe. Like, she's very young, but I guess it makes sense to give her a Lifetime Achievement Award. And it's like, no, it's a Rolex ad?
Well, the whole thing about Rolex ads is they have nothing to do with watches.
Well, for a long time, Rolex has done a campaign with the Academy Awards, but it's usually tied to directors, which makes sense.
Not really, because I'll like be driving down Sunset Boulevard and there will be a billboard of Kathryn Bigelow winning her Oscar, not wearing a Rolex. And then it just says Rolex.
I guess my point about them tying it to directors is like, well, directors are older, so I guess that makes sense. But I don't know if Zendaya is inspiring young people to go out and buy Rolexes.
Absolutely not.
And they couldn't get Ryan Coogler because he was wearing a very cool reissue of the Cartier Tank Watch with his Vuitton outfit.
Speaking of which, do you want to get into some outfits?
Sure, let's do it.
I found the Oscars to be quite hooey this year at the actual ceremony. Of course, there are a lot of bigger celebrities and more interesting outfits at the Vanity Fair after party. But if we're strictly speaking about the people that were physically present at the Oscars, to me, my best dress was Anna Wintour.
Okay.
And my reasoning is that her outfit reflected personal style in a way that I didn't really see from other people at the Oscars, apart from like Spike Lee or something, who also looked great.
Right. I mean, Amy Madigan has been wearing suiting all throughout the award season. She wore a Dior suit, which was very fun. So I feel like that felt associated with her personal style. But I agree with you. I do think either the impact of fashion police, or perhaps its absence, has caused people to get very safe on the red carpet.
Or to think that you can only wear a gown. And that's why Anna Wintour and Amy Madigan both looked cool. Both in Dior, by the way. I also loved Miyako Belizzi, who wore vintage Dior. She was the costume designer for Marty Supreme.
It was a dress from Tab Vintage. And as Vogue explained to me, she was in custom Pandora jewelry, which I just got to say, congratulations on that check. Richly deserved.
Well, it didn't take away from the look.
No.
Which was important. I can't say the same for Mia Goth, who wore a really, really beautiful Dior dress, white asymmetric Dior gown, a Galliano throwback, I will say. But she didn't wear Dior shoes. She wore very basic, simple Stuart Weitzman shoes. And I'm like, how much do they pay her for that?
Look, we may love Pearl, but Pearl doesn't pay the bills, okay? As we learn from Shia LaBeouf, she is a single mother now. She needs that Stuart Weitzman check, so I'll give that to her. Rose Byrne was also in Dior.
I think this was the most successful of the old Hollywood throwback looks, for sure.
Right.
Very well executed.
Although it did look oddly similar to Anne Hathaway's dress, which might make a little more sense if we go with your conspiracy theory that Anne Hathaway was a last-minute replacement as a presenter.
Yeah, it was two different designers doing the same concept, basically. Both very well executed.
Anne Hathaway was in Valentino, right?
Yeah. I think Rose Byrne's look was better and also looked great.
We'll get into it when we get into the Vanity Fair party. But oftentimes, a lot of people who attend the Oscars and also the Vanity Fair party. Their Vanity Fair outfits are much more interesting. And I felt that that was the case with Rose Byrne. She also wore Dior to the after party, but it was this two-piece, like a long beaded skirt and kind of a bandeau top, which I thought would have been an interesting choice, especially because we didn't even talk about the fact that Jessie Buckley won Best Actress, mostly because
neither of us saw Hamnet, for one thing.
Oh, I have been non-consensually shown the sun dying scene on TikTok, which I did not care for and immediately started crying. So no, I will not be watching the rest of Hamnet. Exactly how Chloe Zhao intended me to see Hamnet, an out of context clip on TikTok.
See, I liked Rose Byrne's after party look, but I think in this instance, she actually did pick the correct gown for the Oscars. If for no other reason than the Vanity Fair look was a little more informal, and I feel like that should be the point of an after party look. I find it deeply weird when people change into something even more over the top for the after party. Like, this is where you're supposed to wear something shorter, lighter, less voluminous, more fun.
I guess my thought of Rose Byrne wearing the Vanity Fair after party look to the Oscars is just because, I mean, she had won some awards, but she wasn't likely to win that night. I always think it's fun when someone that has no stake in the Oscars just decides to wear something fun and interesting.
I don't know if she had no chance. I thought there was definitely a possibility. Obviously, I expected Jessie Buckley to win.
Should we talk about her? She was in Chanel.
Didn't love that. Mostly just because I feel like any other designer could have done it. If you told me it was Givenchy or Carolina Herrera or anyone, I would have been like, yeah, of course it is.
And also, out of all of the celebrities that were dressed by Chanel for the Oscars, her look was just the most out of place compared to Matu Blazy's vision for Chanel, like, which was better shown through Pedro Pascal or Nicole Kidman, certainly Teyana Taylor.
I feel like Nicole Kidman is the only person who wore Chanel that actually looked like Chanel. Like, Nicole Kidman's dress could have been designed by Carl very easily.
Oh, yeah. It looked like she just walked out of a Chanel No. 5 ad.
Teyana Taylor had one of my favorite gowns of the night, although it looked like a Cavalli gown.
Right. Also, I didn't realize till much later, Maya Rudolph also in Chanel.
That looked great on her. And I liked Pedro Pascal quite a bit. I like the fact that he didn't wear a jacket. Why not? He's just a presenter. Who gives a shit?
I know. But I do wonder where this ends, right? Because for a long time, men have not been wearing ties. Now we're not wearing blazers.
Because he had to show off that big, beautiful chrysanthemum brooch.
Can we discuss the startling range, let's say, of the Louis Vuitton looks on the red carpet?
Yeah, where do you want to start?
Well, I mean, let's just juxtapose Chase Infinity's outfit versus Emma Stone's outfit, which, thank God, I didn't go on Polymarket. It was not, as we predicted, one of the last two looks from the latest collection.
Which sucks, because that would have been a lot cooler. For me, I actively disliked Chase Infinity's look for the same reasons that I dislike the Jessie Buckley look. I feel like anyone could have designed that, or any evening gown designer. Somehow they managed to make a dress that does not reflect the aesthetic of either one of their creative directors at all.
Correct. And also, I think I'm going to sound real old school fashion police, but like, the dress wore her.
I just don't understand what Louis Vuitton has to gain from putting something out like that. I just don't get it. Emma Stone, I guess I'm more just indifferent about that look.
It was fine. They also dressed Ryan Coogler and his wife, Zinzi Coogler. They looked great.
They dressed Michael B. Jordan, of course. Again, I was kind of indifferent towards that. Did they kill it with anyone? Like,
Renata Rinesby?
Okay, that was good.
However, did you see her Vanity Fair after party look? Because that was giving shine. It was something.
I didn't see that.
Oof.
I thought she looked really chic at the Oscars, but again, Nicolas Ghesquiere's Louis Vuitton doesn't look like that. Pharrell's Louis Vuitton doesn't look like that. Although I have to applaud Carla Welch for being seemingly the only person that knows how to work with this Louis Vuitton, like, VIP atelier,
right,
in a sane way, apart from maybe whoever is styling the Heim sisters these days.
Oh, yeah. The Heim sisters were in LV as well.
Or just one of them. Were they all there?
Sorry.
I only saw Alana.
Sorry, Alana Heim.
Alana looked good. And Alana certainly looks like she's wearing something designed by Nicola Ghesquiere, which I can't really say for anyone else. Can we talk about my favorite alt girl? There's always one at the Oscars. This year it was Chloe Zhao and Gabriella Hearst, who looked like the angel of death or something.
She wore a black veil, which many people took as a comment about the recent news that her Buffy reboot had been canceled, to which I saw this on the red carpet. She was like, no, it's for Hamnet.
She's also training to become a death doula, apparently.
I saw that in an interview as well.
Which I'm kind of inspired by. She was like, I'm so afraid of dying that, like, if I don't get right with death, the second half of my life is going to be completely miserable.
I mean, that's a fair way to think about it.
It's smart. It's proactive, certainly.
She seems to run a very cool set. She meditates with people before calling action. Seems like a cool place to be.
So how are you coping with the Buffy news?
I'm okay. I got several text messages about this. Certainly not as many as friend of the show Evan Ross Katz, but, you know, I know that we give a lot of shit to Daddy MPK for And Just Like That, but I have to give credit to the actors of And Just Like That for being like, we're not making the show without him. Because I think the moment has passed with Buffy, and Buffy, for better or for worse, mostly for worse, comes from the brain of Joss Whedon. And without him, I don't think you really have anything. But I also don't think we should have a Joss Whedon rebooted version of Buffy. So I'm okay with this. The amount of press that's come out and has leaked. Right before we recorded, I saw some headline of Sarah Michelle Gellar, who unfortunately is promoting a different movie this week. That's the thing I don't understand, is why they released this news 36 hours before Chloe Zhao was going to be on the red carpet for a film that she was Oscar nominated for, and the week before Sarah Michelle Gellar was going on a big press tour for the film Ready or Not 2.
I would imagine as a fuck you to Hulu.
Why, that they keep talking about it?
Yeah, especially because of Chloe Zhao's Oscar nomination. It's like you fumbled the bag with something that people were really excited about with this incredibly critically acclaimed director.
I know, but like Sarah Michelle Gellar's quote was like, please don't go find the script or watch. And I hope that the pilot doesn't leak.
Right.
So it seems unsalvageable, and that's okay.
Well, they tried.
Who else do we got?
Well, we haven't talked about Timmy, who everyone shat on. I didn't think his look was bad. Like, I wasn't thrilled by it, but I don't know why it inspired so much hatred.
I think he can't do anything right. People pointed out they juxtaposed him in a white tux in, I believe, 2018 when he was first nominated with this look. I think people don't like how cocky he has been, and people have thought that perhaps he did think he was going to win an Oscar that night, and so he wore an outfit that kind of looked like a version of what he wore the first time he was nominated to the Oscars.
Well, it's not like he looked super fashion-y or anything.
What I thought was funnier is that for the after party, he wore an all-white outfit, but it was just a Chrome Hearts version of what he wore on the red carpet.
Why not?
My personal favorite menswear look was Buddy Guy, who showed up in leather overalls and a polka dot button-down shirt. I could not find an outfit credit anywhere, but he looked major. And these are the types of risks I'm talking about that I would like people to start taking again on the red carpet.
For sure. What did you think about Gwyneth's Armani?
Surprised it was Armani as opposed to Calvin Klein. It was very, very minimalist and white. I love it. I mean, she's got the body to pull it off. Why not?
For sure. I guess I'm kind of indifferent towards it. I guess I didn't like how structured and like molded the bust was, but I guess it had to be that way for the dress to stay on her body, since one side of the dress was completely open, akin to the Showgirls poster.
She was well ventilated on a hot day. I'm sure she appreciated what she wore that night.
Can we get into Demi, who had one of the more dramatic looks, I would say.
We are getting our first taste of Demna's Gucci on the red carpet. A lot of feathers. Very Bob Mackie. Wasn't expecting this.
Yeah, very Dietrich, very diva. It was a throwback to a feathered gown from the Frida Giannini era that I guess Evan Rachel Wood wore to the Golden Globes or something years ago. but a more like amped up cunty version of that, of course. I've been trying to forget about that era of Gucci for years now.
Well, Demna's not going to let you.
But that was kind of the only Gucci dress that wasn't a skin tight, slinky bodycon crystal dress.
Right. Most notably, Kim Kardashian wore very much what we saw on the runway a few weeks ago of Demna's vision for women in Gucci.
Didn't love.
No.
Didn't need that.
Also didn't need her to be wearing blue contacts.
No. I see what they were trying to do with the glam, but I don't think it was successful. Because as we know, Kim Kardashian just isn't a messy person.
Yeah, and you could really tell how purposeful the messiness was if you watch the video of how she keeps trying to restructure and reposition the messy over one eye hair that she has.
Yeah. Also, I just think that the gown was genuinely boring. I get it. You're supposed to look like the Oscar, but the fucked up Hollywood Boulevard version of that.
Which we ourselves over the years have picked up a bunch of novelty Oscars at those shops.
Of course.
Laura Harrier was also in Demna Gucci at the Vanity Fair after party.
I feel like that was the better crystal dress.
It was, but here's the confusing thing, and we discussed this a lot when we were talking about this Gucci collection, but I don't know if you noticed this. Revolve has come out with their own collection, and several people at the Vanity Fair Oscar party were wearing the new Revolve line, which doesn't look too dissimilar to Demna's Gucci. So it was a little confusing, but I think that's what Demna's going for.
Speaking of confusing, Fran Drescher was wearing a black form-fitting sequin turtleneck gown. And for a split second, I was like, oh my God, is this the Kate Moss Gucci?
Are we about to see former Screen Actors Guild president in a G-string Gucci thong?
But that's something she would have worn in the 90s. Totally.
Absolutely.
It actually is consistent with her style. But unfortunately, we did not get that fabulous reveal, although she looked great. So to move on to the after party, what did you love?
I mean, I've already talked about my love for Rose Byrne, but we can move on. I mean, Jessie Buckley was just in a better dress at the after party than she was on the red carpet.
For sure.
I did notice that Mia Goth was wearing a different Dior gown. And this one, it was very clear. It sort of goes against your point of being more casual at the Vanity Fair party. This was very voluminous, but I think it was a better choice because that would be very hard to sit down for 3 hours during an award show in that dress.
I loved Mia Goth's Vanity Fair look. I preferred it to the one she actually wore to the Oscars, but I understand your point.
And I was surprised to see Demi switched into a new gown for the Vanity Fair party, but it was Balenciaga, not Gucci. I don't know if it was Demna era Balenciaga, probably.
I don't know. I don't think she's wearing clothes from seasons past. Not Demi. Some of these other bitches, absolutely.
Well, speaking of which, can we talk about Julia Fox and Victor and Rolf? Because that was
old.
That was a 2022 spring summer couture look. And I'm just fascinated by that choice because, you know, the red carpet has been overrun by archival looks. Anya Taylor-Joy was in a archival John Galliano look that I'm frankly just sick of. But like the idea of wearing something that's not exactly archival technically, it's just a few years old and no one has worn it before. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, I thought it was very cool. Also, that's kind of been the only good Victor and Rolf collection in a really long time. Or I remember thinking that because that was the show that they did where it looked like everyone had these really high exaggerated shoulders.
Uncle Fester, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah, I thought she looked cool. I was into that. I loved Sarah Paulson.
Of course.
In Fecal Matter. Best dressed at the party. Completely different silhouette than everyone else. Also, not a gown. An ensemble of some point. It seemed like a skirt with some sort of corset and then a jacket.
I mean, her relationship with Carla Welch is, I think, one of the most successful styling relationships in Hollywood right now.
I feel like it's also a little bit symbiotic. Not that Carla Welch herself fully dresses like that, but kind of.
And they also look quite similar, depending on how short Sarah Paulson's hair is at the time.
Yeah, it seems like Sarah Paulson is like a slightly femmier version of Carla Welch.
do we need Persona, but it's about a relationship between an actress and a fashion stylist?
Would watch. Also, Holland looked cute. Nice to see a woman of a certain age or an octogenarian in something other than like a satin pantsuit or like the world's ugliest, like long-sleeved lace gown.
I have to say they looked hot.
Yeah.
Any other celesbians?
Well, did you see Glennon Doyle and Abby?
I did indeed.
Glennon's journey from Christian mommy blogger to late in life lesbian with a pave crystal fuck ice clutch is very inspiring to me.
We love a late in life lesbian here on the Every Outfit podcast.
Who else? Oh, the one lesbian Meryl Streep daughter looked cool.
Yes.
I can't really tell my gummers apart, but I know one of them's married to Mark Ronson. One of them's a lesbian. The other one I know nothing about.
We're talking about the one that is on the Gilded Age who chose a name that is neither Streep nor Gummer, so no one could tell that she's Meryl Streep's child.
Apart from the face, of course.
Yes, but she was in, we talked about this during New York Fashion Week, just the full leather Kate look.
Yeah, I thought she looked great. I don't know if I need the wallet chain situation happening that takes the look into Michael Jackson territory for me, but I thought she looked fabulous.
There were two people that I thought looked very good. Dua Lipa was in Schiaparelli, always a good combination of starlet and designer, but
I don't even think I saw that.
It was very form-fitting, very hot. Hailey Bieber was also there, and I only want to bring it up because she was in Armani Privé in a very not Armani Privé looking outfit.
Well, yeah, leopard print is the last thing we associate with Armani.
That's what I was going to say.
I loved Bella Hadid in Prada. So gorgeous. So fab. These CBK bitches wish.
Well, speaking of which, maybe the most brilliant pairing of a designer and a star that we saw was Sarah Pidgeon in Calvin Klein with a bag that looked like a CK bottle.
The CK1 bottle. Or the CKB bottle. Either one.
But I feel like this can only mean one thing.
Yeah, was this a brand ambassador hard launch situation?
I hope so. It can't just be Dakota Johnson in her underwear.
I think it would be very smart of Calvin Klein to have her be a brand ambassador, although it would also be deeply sinister if you think about it, from the sense that they're kind of profiting off of this heavily dramatized story about a former employee that had no say in it.
That's fair. At the very least, it was a fun moment at the Vanity Fair party.
For sure. We also saw Connor Story and YSL.
I mean, I believe he was made for a sheer shirt.
Yeah, very hot. I usually hate a sheer shirt, but he can pull it off. Also, I love the diamond necklace and the fur and stuff.
Can I give a special award for best plus one?
Sure. To who?
Leonardo DiCaprio's latest girlfriend, Victoria Ceretti, was in Alaya. It was burgundy. It was a form-fitting dress with this circular kind of chest plate that went up to her clavicle. And best yet, she did not change into a different outfit for the after party. She stayed in the same dress all night. You know this is my pet peeve. I have to call out Chris Evans' wife changed into a new dress for the after party. Look, I get it. You win an award, change into a different outfit for the Vanity Fair party. Diversify those photos. But your husband is a presenter. Why do you need to change into a new outfit for the after party?
I agree. Unless you are in a very constrictive gown and you are changing into a little slip dress or something.
No, she changed into a different gown.
I swear to God, they change into like even bigger gowns now. It's like so mental. See, I think the best plus one was Susie Cave in Tom Ford. She was probably the best dressed person there, honestly.
And I heard from someone who got to speak to her that night that, you know, and let's take this with a grain of salt, but allegedly Vampire's Wife is coming back.
Praise be. I also really loved Devin Lee Carlson in a Yves Saint Laurent gown that was very like Narciso doing Galliano for CBK kind of vibe. But I love that it was slit so high up the back that you actually saw her ass cheek, which I don't know if I've ever seen that before. I can't recall ever seeing that. Ass is on the menu, as Samantha once said.
I can't believe it's taken us this long to discuss Kris Jenner and Chanel.
That was crazy because she was clearly living out some sort of like Claudia Cardinale type Italian fantasy with that look. Like that was giving like, what did Kim say? Her Dolce Vita lifestyle?
Yeah. I don't know if you saw this from the Hollywood Reporter, but this is some anonymous person reporting from the Vanity Fair party that the lighting was so bright that it terrified the people that were there. This person goes, I genuinely feel bad for some of these women. One poor actress looked like a Dionne Arbus character. She was on her phone looking at her photos and shrieking at her publicist. I heard that she went home and cried herself to sleep.
Anyone know who that was? Please let us know. That sucks, though. The lighting shouldn't make you look like shit.
No, if anything, that high wattage should make you look as ageless as Kris Jenner currently does. It's the cameras, okay? We don't need a Canon to be able to take 8K photos.
Speaking of old school glamour, what did you think about Rita Ora's insane Mae West hat?
Well, yeah, doesn't this go against your rule of like, you should be wearing something simpler to the Vanity Fair party?
Did she even go to the main Oscars though?
Oh, I see. If you are only invited to the Vanity Fair Oscars party, then it's totally fine to pull an insane look.
Well, I don't know if this is totally fine, but she did it.
How many people do you think she knocked in the head with her Mae West hat?
God knows.
Or do you think she took it off inside?
I hope she took it off inside.
It doesn't even fit into that photo booth that everyone wants to take photos in. Can we also discuss, all right, if Holland Taylor and Sarah Paulson are the lesbian couple of the night, is the straight couple of the night Jeff Goldblum and his wife? Ass was also on the menu for her.
I think they looked really cool. They pulled like an old school, or not an old school, maybe more of a 90s VMAs style couples look.
Right.
Because both of their looks involved this like black and white fur. I thought it was fun. They weren't taking it too seriously.
They never do, and that's what's great about them. His wife, Emily Livingston, was in a bodysuit, of which you could also see her ass cheeks when she turned back, which is how she posed in most of her couples photos with Jeff Goldblum.
I'm into it.
Oh boy. Is that it for the Oscars?
Let's let that be it. I'm ready to move on.
Yes. Honestly, I've been waiting all episode to get into these topics.
So, first of all, we wanted to get into this Gwyneth Paltrow auction at our favorite local auction house, Julian's.
Well, yes. We're going to talk about two auctions. So you want to start with Gwyneth Paltrow because they're also doing one with Whoopi Goldberg.
Well, that one ended already.
No, there's a part two of
Whoopi.
Oh,
really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, I didn't see part two. I think I just saw part one.
And why I want to bring up both of these Julian's auctions is because they're diametrically opposed, I feel. Because Whoopi is doing an auction that you would expect from a celebrity, which is like, clearly she's moving out of a house. She's clearing out a storage unit. Gwyneth Paltrow is treating this Julian's auction like it's her very own Kardashian's closet.
Yeah, there's some very good clothes in this auction, I will say. Although there is a lot of like G label. It'll be like a lot of like three G label skirts. And it's like, you don't even care about this anymore.
Oh, this sale might as well be called the stuff Apple Martin didn't want closet sale / G label sample sale.
There is some really great stuff in it, but it's all things that I can't imagine her ever wearing. Like that pink Vivian Westwood bondage suit. Like, when did she wear that?
So I've looked at this sale several times and they trick you because the first 20 lots are Gwyneth Paltrow's, but I believe Julian's auction is using this Gwyneth Paltrow auction to launder other designer stuff they have, because at a certain point, it's just random designer pieces that are not related to Gwyneth Paltrow. Are not owned by Gwyneth Paltrow.
Wait, what?
Go to the auction. Scroll down.
Okay, that explains a lot.
But the first 20, 30 pieces are hers. But it's stuff like, remember the famous pink Ralph Lauren Oscar dress she wore when she won her Oscar? Well, that's not for sale, but the illustrations are.
But why is she selling that? Like, she can't be that hard up. Like, I fundamentally don't understand this sale. Because it's like, why is she selling a couple of random Restoration Hardware club chairs?
Right. I mean, there's stuff like Gwyneth Paltrow's Mark and Graham Toten hat, and the hat is customized with Mrs. Falchuk. And the caption says, Gwyneth was photographed wearing these pieces at the Four Seasons Resort in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico for her hen weekend in April 2018. And it's like, okay, clearly one of her friends or an assistant or maybe even Mark and Graham themselves sent this to her and now she's selling it.
She has way too much personalized shit and is selling all of it in this auction.
My favorite offering is a lot called Gwyneth Paltrow 2024 Instagram look. Givenchy black silk blouse and Arlo skirt with image.
Okay, why is she selling autographed 8x10s though?
To make buying a tote hat that has her husband's name on it worth it, I guess?
I'm just confused. Like, to me, this seems like stuff that should just be, like, given away.
There is some good stuff. So there is a Johnny Versace silk jacket with the original tag still attached. And the description of this piece does not give me the gossip I want because it's a beautiful piece that she's never worn. Like, clearly it's from the 90s. So why does it have the original tags? Like, did Harvey Weinstein gift this to her? And she's like, this is just a cursed object?
Versace probably gave it to her.
But why does it have the original tag still?
She never wore it. It didn't suit her then. She hung on to it. I'm sure this woman has been given so much stuff over the years, and I'm sure that half of this stuff is directly from the brands, I would imagine.
Yes, and I guess Apple Martin didn't want that piece. That's like the only piece I would bid on because I'm like, I would wear that.
There was also a really great Versace ensemble that was like a gray tunic with a matching pant, and it had this kind of beaded coral trim. I feel like modest Versace is always a good look. And of course, that image of CBK in her like white long sleeve Versace gown has been all over the internet recently. I feel like this Versace ensemble was from a similar time period.
For sure. So to me, the far more interesting sale is the Whoopi Goldberg sale.
Which just reinforced everything I knew about Whoopi Goldberg, which is that the only shit that she cares about buying is like Art Deco furniture, weird like novelty high heels from like Charlotte Olympia and like Irregular Choice and shit. And then like racist memorabilia, like cookie jars and figurines and shit.
Yeah.
Which she's talked about before on The View.
And now she's trying to unload.
She's like, I have way too many racist teapots, guys.
Yeah, I would say that the most surprising lot for sale, and I sent it to you, was just a ceramic bust of Chinese man.
Yeah, I found that to be odd also.
So there's memorabilia, there's costumes, furniture, jewelry, not only jewelry, but loose gemstones and several lots of loose gemstones. What is going on? I need the professional closet organizer that like went through her stuff and helped identify what was going to be sold for, as I said, the two-part Julian's auction.
Wow, I got to check out part two.
Well, another thing that I gleaned from this sale is that it's clear that Whoopi designs or has someone design a custom ornament for herself. And perhaps that's what she sends out with her Christmas cards, because there's one Whoopi themed ornament for literally the last 10 years that are for sale.
She also has a lot of her own memorabilia, more than I would expect her to keep. Like, why do you have a framed Boys on the Side poster?
Well, I was so close to buying you the signed by Whoopi Boys on the Side custom art that must have been used during production. If it was a signed poster, I would have gotten it for you, but it was a little
random.
The
poster wasn't signed, and I saw that it sold for like $150 or something. I love that movie, but not enough to have a framed Boys on the Side poster in my house for life.
Well, it's very interesting what matters to her versus what doesn't, because there's a sister act clearly used like walk-on mat that is for sale. At least to me, it's clear that she has kept her costumes from sister act, but she is selling her costumes from Karina Karina.
That's fine. As long as she has Dolores Van Cartier's purple fur coat from the beginning of sister act, we're good.
And guys, do not worry. We are well aware that the next Julian's auction that is up is an end just like that prop and costume auction.
They've currently only released a few images of items that are in the sale. The most noteworthy, I would say, being the Love Samantha card that accompanied the floral arrangement that she sent to Mr. Big's funeral. There's also a copy of Carrie Bradshaw's grief memoir, Loved and Lost.
We might need that.
Yeah, I'm interested in that.
I don't need LTW's tennis outfit, but I might need the fake widow memoir prop that Carrie wrote.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how many items are in this sale and when it's actually happening, because I don't think that's been announced either.
I believe it begins April 3rd and then it goes for the entire month. It's a very long sale.
Well, I'm sure we'll find something that strikes our fancy.
Shall we move on to something else that caught our attention this week, which is they are remaking Single White Female. The writer of Bodies, 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 Sarah Delap, has been tasked with remaking Single White Female. It is now called Single Female. It will star Jenna.
Sorry, I'm still not over that, but continue.
It will star Jenna Ortega and Taylor Russell, which is probably why it has shifted to Single Female.
Okay, there is no logical excuse for it being called Single Female.
It does not roll off the tongue well.
Like, I'm here for a race-swapped version of Single White Female, but this title is crazy, especially when Single Black Female is right there.
Right. For those who have not seen Single White Female, it is based on a book called SWF Seek Same from 1990. This, of course, stood for Single White Female Seeks Same, which was a newspaper ad. In the movie, they do not say
Seek Same.
But the story concerns Bridget Fonda, who is cheated on by her boyfriend. She moves into an apartment. She seeks a roommate. And Jennifer Jason Leigh shows up. And Jennifer Jason Leigh increasingly becomes obsessed with her and becomes her. Which is funny that they cast two famously blonde actresses and then made Bridget Fonda get a very bizarre, very Miranda Hobbs at the beginning of Sex and the City 2 red bowl cut.
Yeah, it was very that. And I wonder what hairstyle they are going to give these two women. Because I can imagine this working based on the way that they both look physically. I think with a very specific hairstyle and the right makeup, I can see this happening for sure.
Well, this does beg the question. I don't know how to say it any other way, but people keep calling this a woke remake of Single White Female, but perhaps it's anti-woke. If they're going to follow the plot at the very least, that one of them becomes obsessed with the other and then starts becoming and looking like the other one.
So Jenna Ortega may be blackfishing is what you're saying.
I don't know. I mean, this is the writer of Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. I have to think that there's going to be a satirical element to this film.
Yeah, and I wonder what the racial politics of the film are going to be, simply because obviously the removal of any indication of race from the title does feel pointed.
There's no way that they keep that title. This is also my issue with remakes in general, because I understand the studio logic of this, right? Which is, we'll pick a title of a successful film and we'll remake it because there's IP in that. People kind of know what the movie is. But this has never made sense to me, because either people know what the film is and like the original and aren't going to see a remake, or people don't know what the original is and aren't going to see this remake.
Well, also, you can make a Single White Female type movie and not use the Single White Female IP. Like, that's basically what Ingrid Goes West was.
Right.
I don't see the point of doing it if the title isn't going to somewhat resemble what it was. Even if it's Single Latina Female, maybe that's too many syllables, but because the race doesn't have to apply to both actresses. It's just the one that places the ad.
But again, a big point of the film is they both look eerily identical to each other by the end. So I just am wondering what the premise of this remake could possibly be.
Look, I would guess that they will find another scarily specific hairstyle that will unite these women, and with the right makeup. But of course, it has to be incredibly convincing, because one of them has to blow the other one's boyfriend.
I'm glad you said it and not me, because I'm tired of getting negative comments that I spoil movies from 30 or 40 years ago. But yes, the most infamous fucking scene is that Bridget Fonda's boyfriend can't tell that he's not getting blown by Bridget Fonda because Jennifer Jason Leigh has the same fucking haircut.
Look, who knows? They could both have like platinum Louise Brooks haircuts or something, for all we know.
If you haven't seen the original film, I highly recommend it. It is a good low-key woman with a fashion job film, because if you remember, Bridget Fonda's like a
swimwear designer, I think.
She's like a CAD designer for a swimwear company, yeah.
Yeah, I love it.
Speaking of designers, our world was rocked by the news that John Galliano is coming back to an atelier, but that atelier is Zara.
I'm not that surprised by it. He wanted that check. Like, is that so crazy? I don't think this necessarily indicates that this will be his only job for the rest of time.
This is very true. He signed a 2-year creative partnership with Zara that will see him, quote, reauthor the brand's archives.
And that's bizarre because the archive is copies of clothing from famous fashion designers. I want to see him interpret his archive for Zara, not the other way around.
It's just a funny way to phrase it. Like, if John Galliano was designing a seasonal collection for Zara, that would be one thing. But to refer to it several times in the press release of like, oh, I've been curating their archives, or I'm reauthoring things from the archive, I don't know what that means.
Is he like literally deconstructing pieces from the archive and turning them into new pieces? Because that would be kind of cool.
That's interesting. And surprisingly sustainable.
I'm surprised at the extent of the backlash around this.
Is there backlash?
I've seen a lot of backlash that's like, ew, fast fashion. And I'm just kind of like, where do you guys shop? Because most people I know are buying clothes at Zara or Uniqlo or Target or something. I know very few people that either exclusively wear designer or exclusively wear vintage.
Right. And there is this kind of no-win argument where it feels like the people who are like, ooh, he's designing for Zara fast fashion are the same people that are like, designer luxury clothes should be more affordable. And it's like, you can't have it both ways.
No, and I think we have to clarify what we mean by fast fashion. I always love to hear what Jeremy Lewis has to say. He has the Instagram handle at Lewis Mag, and he made the point that people are using the term fast fashion very liberally to describe what is essentially mass market clothing, and that there is actually a difference. Because fast fashion is like, let's take something from the runway, knock it off before it even hits stores at Chloe or Prada or wherever, and make a shitload of this very trendy piece that will then immediately go into a landfill. Whereas mass market clothes aren't necessarily trendy.
It's funny, speaking of the Oscars, you saying that made me think of, I feel like in the early 2000s, there was a thing, I think the brand was ABS Schwartz or something, mm-hmm. where they would famously knock off the most famous Oscar dresses and like have them available within a week.
That was great. So you could wear like Gwyneth Paltrow's Ralph Lauren dress to prom or whatever.
Yeah, that's fast fashion.
Exactly. So I think that criticism is a little elitist also, because isn't the whole argument with fast fashion that these clothes go out of fashion quite quickly? If Galliano has proved anything, is that he's been a designer that has been able to design clothes that people still care about years later.
And I feel like it is on the consumer, just because you buy clothing from a quote unquote fast fashion retailer. I think it also got a bad name because of style bloggers and this idea of constantly needing to be wearing new clothing, different outfits. If you have pieces from a Uniqlo, a Zara for years to come, then it's not fast fashion. You are consuming it in a semi-ethical way if you have it in your closet for years.
Exactly. But I wonder what the price point will be, because Zara does randomly make clothes that are expensive here and there, or more expensive than you would expect.
Well, I feel like this hasn't been in the conversation enough, which is, there's a lot of conversation about why John Galliano would do this, not enough conversation, in my opinion, about why Zara is doing this, because they have really refocused in the last couple years of going more upmarket, let's say. You know, they now have their Zara Home offering, which has some pretty incredibly designed stuff.
Yeah. Well, they don't want to be perceived as being in the same category as Shein and Fashion Nova.
Right.
And this is a very strategic way to distance themselves from that further. And I can't blame them. And I think that's the right thing to do.
Also, as I referenced earlier in this episode, you know, Revolve has their own line. Zara having an in-house collection with John Galliano, it might be a price point that is more expensive than the most expensive Zara clothing item, but less than a designer piece.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting price category to be in. So we'll see.
Although I do want to point out that you can get some very good deals on Galliano Margiela, particularly menswear, on the RealReal. That may perhaps be even cheaper than some of the Zara stuff when it hits stores.
Okay, before we go, do we have anything to apologize for?
I don't have anything.
I think I should apologize because it's come to my attention that some people were insulted that in discussing the Sylvia Plath adaptation and Billie Eilish being cast as Esther, I did refer to the fact that I didn't imagine Esther having big fat naturals. And some people took offense to that.
Sorry, just the way you said big fat naturals really got me.
If you were insulted, I'm sorry.
Do better.
I'll try to do better next week. Is when it starts, where we will be doing a Sex and the City rewatch episode. What episode? We don't even know yet.
We shall see. Bye, guys.
Bye.